morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 24th of January. Very nice to have you with us on our program this morning. We are getting started here. We're just waiting because there was a taping just prior to this with two of our panelists, Alan Chartok and Blair Horner, and they'll be coming in just a moment. So let me introduce the two panelists who are here and roaring and ready to go. We're very excited. Yes.
I'm fired up.
Well, good. You have a lot to be fired up about. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a communications consultant. And for those of you who may or may not know this, Teresa had she broke some bones in her hand and was in a cast and a sling and all kinds of things. And when that was the case, she wasn't able to bring her laptop with her. And I think you felt severely limited because you didn't have instant access to the...
Yeah, you asked me to read a tweet and I couldn't do it. I knew it was there, but I couldn't find it. It was just terrible. I couldn't find my factoids.
So after several weeks, today is the return of the laptop.
Yeah, facts are back.
I think... Oh, if only that were true, Teresa. If only that were true. But we hope, at least on this program, you'll be able to fact check us in real time, and that's very good. So it's good to see you back, feeling well enough to.
I can carry my laptop.
Have your laptop in tow.
I can use my mouse with my right hand. It's just.
It's all good. All is good. Jen Smith is here. She's a Berkshire Eagle reporter, and she always has her device with her. So no. Impairments with your hands, so you're good to go. Good morning, Jen. How
good
are you?
Good morning. It's good to be back in the smaller round table, too, and to be closer. Last time on Friday, we were very far apart, Teresa.
Right.
It felt really weird.
Not philosophically,
no.
Just geographically.
Yeah, it's just geographically.
And
I
was in between Chris and Rich.
And I was so pleased that you talked about Betsy DeVos. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Really
yes, handy. you got applause for that.
Yeah.
It shows that people cares, and there are a lot of, I think, educators in the audience, too, and feel underheard, and those issues need to be addressed.
My high school social studies teacher was there.
Who again?
Great.
She
said
it again. That's great.
I was so excited. Chris Trombley Cashin, awesome teacher.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and she said that when I'd spoken with about her on the radio the last time, talking about how important teachers are, that other people heard it. So anyway, so
all
she
right.
came.
We're gonna get our other two panelists in here, and we're gonna take a quick break. We'll get them seated. We'll get them mic'd up, and then we have a little business to do regarding the lockbox, and we'll be. On our way to talk about the issues of the day. We'll do all of that right after this. What can you accomplish in a minute and a half? Well, you can bring in two wonderful panelists who are here. They were recording a show prior, so we just gave them a little time for traveling and to get seated and mic'd up. Wow, he hasn't been with us for a while. We're excited to have him. It seems like it takes a trial to get him here.
Hopefully not against me.
Not against you. No. Blair Horner is here. He is the executive director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group, and it's always a pleasure to have Blair Horner with us. Good morning, sir. Welcome.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, good morning. I introduced everybody else while you were gone. So Alan Chartok is here as well. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm working so hard.
Since the station opened, have you not worked hard?
I've always worked hard, but I think we're approaching the breaking point here. But it's great because when you have Blair Horner here in the studio, it's really quite remarkable that we have the top guy who knows more about state politics than anybody I know, and we were very pleased to have him on our Capital Connection show today. By the way, Joe, I think I should probably mention that at today at Vox Pop, we'll have Congressman John Faso, Republican of the 19th District.
Thank
and
you.
For those of you who wish to ask Congressman Faso any question, up or down, please make sure that you get on the phone early at 348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And don't be yelling at me later on that you missed your chance, because this is the time to do it. Okay, so then, Joe, we have some other business to discuss.
Yes, we have incredible. Amazing lockbox news.
Now, you will all remember that this amazing, amazing Hudson Valley resident came up with a $10,000 match if we could make it for the fun drive.
Wow.
Right. Wow is right, Blair. But what you don't know is that she sat there and she said, you know what? The 10 isn't enough. I'm going to raise it to $50,000 as a challenge. If we can make that $50,000 challenge, it'll be fantastic. Now, that's the most money anybody has ever put for the lockbox. If we can get to $1.5 million in the lockbox, that'll be great. We'll then be in a position to have the same kind of fun drive we've been having all along. But we have a way to go. The current total is $1,061,088 left to go to get that at $500,000, and we can do it because yesterday we made about $50,000. We can do it if
$50,000.
I'm sorry.
To get $50,000.
To get $50,000.
Yep.
Well, left to go is 438-912. I need everybody on a phone. Anything you put in will be good. Now, yesterday I had an irate phone call from a lady who I respect very much, who was very angry with me and us for spending time trying to raise money for the fun drive. Ladies and gentlemen, no fun drive, no money, no station. It's that simple. And so I do want you to know we're doing our best, and what we want to do is get this thing over with as fast as we can so that we don't miss a day of roundtable. It'll be great.
That's right. I mean, we do all of this as fast as possible so we can get back to regular programming. We're still in regular programming now. If we take a couple minutes out to talk about the importance of the lockbox, it's just what we need to do to people are saying, oh, my God, the success of the lockbox. Well, that's because we get to talk about it and let people know about it. Otherwise, you wouldn't have it.
Joe, you're so right. It's always brilliant. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. If you do it now, your day will be off to a great start. I promise you, it can only mean good things in your day. 1-800-323-9262. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about.
Yes. All right. So we want to remind you to go and to do this. And please, please, please help the lockbox, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. We'll be talking about it throughout this morning. Okay, let us begin with, let's talk about the trial that's happening in New York City, because we have Blair here and of course, Alan to talk about what's going on. We haven't really touched on this too much on the panel other than that it was coming up. But the trial opened yesterday. Joseph Prococo was a powerful man, but not a wealthy one, the prosecutor told the jury in the opening of yesterday's trial. So Mr. Prococo decided to sell the most valuable thing he owned, his job, his power, and influence in state government, that prosecutor, Robert Boone. That was how Mr. Boone opened the government's case against Mr. Prococo, who had been a close advisor and friend to Governor Andrew Cuomo. Mr. Prococo is now on trial in federal district court in Manhattan on corruption charges. In his opening statement on Tuesday, Mr. Boone alleged that Mr. Prococo's three co-defendants, executives of two companies that had business before New York State, had been more than happy to buy that influence from him. The widely watched trial is expected to highlight what prosecutors have long said is Albany's corrupt culture of influence peddling and secret dealing, much as previous federal corruption cases in Manhattan have done in recent years. Blair Horner, do you believe that that phrase of Albany's corrupt culture of influence peddling and secret dealing is an accurate one?
Well, you know, I guess I lean toward that agreement. I mean, who knows better in many ways than the U.S. Attorney's Office? They're the ones who actually get to look underneath the hood and see how things operate. And when Barrara, the former U.S. attorney, brought these charges, he said that he wanted it to go to trial because he wanted New Yorkers to see how their state government operates. Now, again, Prococo is presumed innocent until proven guilty. The case may fall apart under intense public scrutiny. We'll see. But certainly the sort of pay-to-play culture of Albany, I think, is well-established and often brazenly on display. Now, whether or not it's illegal is the big question, right? Under state law, there's a lot of things you can do that would raise many eyebrows across the state. But the question of illegality is really where the issue is going to turn. We'll see what happens with Prococo.
That's right, Blair. There is the McDonald decision. Perhaps you could just spend a few seconds on that one.
Oh, my God. Well, all right. I'll do the best I can in a few seconds. Governor of Virginia gets convicted of accepting gifts from entities seeking favors from the government. A particular individual gave money to him, the governor, and his wife. He was convicted. He was widely viewed, in fact, as a possibility for vice president to be on the national ticket. His political career ends. On appeal, the U.S. Supreme Court argues that he wasn't merely setting up meetings and happening to get gifts at the same time is not necessarily illegal. Mind-blowing sort of interpretation of the federal law, but that's their interpretation.
Unbelievable.
And so that has allowed, at least as yet, U.S. Senator Menendez from New Jersey to escape prosecution, and has led to the retrials now of the former New York State Speaker of the Assembly and the former New York State Majority Leader because of the increasingly narrow interpretation of the federal bribery statute that has sort of pulled back the ability of U.S. attorneys to bring actions. Now, the fact that the feds have to swoop into New York to deal with what is alleged corruption in New York, I think underscores the need for state laws to get improved because we shouldn't have to rely on the feds or the federal bribery statute.
And that ain't going to happen, that's for sure.
Come on. My job.
And it is your job, and you do it so well as the head of the New York Public Interest Research Group, which is why you're on the front page of the Times and everywhere else virtually every day. You know, you're right, but it's disgusting.
Ooh, I have a question. So, you do too?
No, you first.
Okay. So,
it's a very nice group here.
Don't you forget that.
I may change my tune after this is over.
So, what does this mean? I mean, it seems like the underlying question here, at least for all of us watching from the outside, is, okay, but what effect will this have one way or the other on the governor of the state of New York?
Yeah, well, I'll give you the unsatisfying answer of it depends what happens in the case. Right. I mean, if Prococo's found innocent, then it's just, you know, take two Excedrin, go to bed, and you'll feel better in the morning for the governor. If he's convicted and it shows a sort of pattern of abuse within the close aides to the governor, then it's more of a body blow to the governor in terms of what he, you know, the public's view of him. And I hope in either circumstance the governor feels enough pressure that he wants to act to sort of fix this system.
And remember, this is a governor who we keep hearing would like to be president of the United States. So a lot is riding on this particular outcome of, you know, this case. Let's all remember, anybody who reads the papers knows that Prococo was referred to in Mario's eulogy as the third brother who he liked the most, who Mario liked the most.
That was described by the governor.
The governor.
Andrew Cuomo. That was his interpretation.
That's come back to bite him in the fanny, I would say.
Well, and I think already we've seen early reports this morning that there have been some attack ads that have been produced against Cuomo and the party, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, Ed Cox, the head of the Republican Party, is obviously pounced on this. He was outside the courtroom, basically having his own news conference, sort of doing his own running commentary on what should be happening. I mean, Cox has to do this, of course, because the Republicans at the moment have not yet figured out who's going to run against the governor. But he's leading the charge. There have been also attack ads from the left. There's a Democratic activist, Bill Samuels, who's run, I think, a political committee called Enough is Enough and has been running some TV ads. And so, you know, it's going to be left-right. There were protesters outside the event. I mean, everyone's going to try to seize on this as an opportunity to make whatever point they want to make. And it won't get better, I don't think, until the governor actually advances some policies to at least argue he's solving the problem.
Teresa, we have about a minute, but go ahead.
This is one of several trials coming up.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's what I was wondering, this in the context of there's this, there's Calieros and others. Yeah. So as a package, what does it all mean?
It's a corruption palooza, actually. There's one every month through July. This month is Prococo. Next month is former state senator. In March is the former Nassau County executive. April is the former Speaker of the Assembly. May is Calieros. June is former Senate Majority Leader. And July, a new one, a current Assemblywoman who will also be going to trial. And who knows what will happen before the end of the day today?
Can you get a ticket pack for all of them? That's
right.
Wait, just have to take a break. We'll be right back. We'll continue this conversation. I know you and Alan both have questions. We'll be right back. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. What a panel we have. Teresa Bourgeois, Blair Horner, Jen Smith, Alan Chartok, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to your letters in just a second. Just a reminder about the lockbox. We want to make sure that you understand the importance of what is happening here because we have $50,000 on the table, and we have to make this challenge, and we only have, it's like 10 days, Alan.
It's actually very little time, and I'm a little, okay, I've always tried to be transparent with everybody. Yesterday, we made the pitch, everybody called, it was great. Today, we made the pitch, we talked about $50,000, and frankly, I'm scared because there's very little activity out there. So I'm asking everybody who's listening, you know, you want to know how many people listen to this radio station every month? 500,000 individuals listen to this radio station. That's a lot of people. So I'm just saying that if everybody who treasures it or who listens to it or who disagrees with it or agrees with it and writes us letters, I had a guy write me a 25-paragraph letter this morning. And he talked about how generous he was. We looked him up. He wasn't there. Now, I'm not trying to blame on anybody, but I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, this radio station cannot be supported by anybody except you. That's the chain. If the chain gets broken, we get broken, and it's the end of it. From the bottom of my heart, I'm just asking that everybody get on a phone now, because right now is when we really need you. And this would be a great time to hear from you. 1-800-323-9262. Again, 1-800, write it down, 1-800-323-9262. Or better even, go to WAMC.org and do it that way. Hey, I'm depending on you. I'm asking you to understand the logic. I'm begging you, not for the money. I'm begging you to understand how we put all of this thing together.
Now, can I bring up this stuff?
Anything you like, Joe.
All right. Have you all seen this? I don't know. Here, Jen. Take a look. You look at that. Blair, I'm going to let you show this off.
Actually. This is the fleece.
This is the package here. We have, because we're doing this in honor of our Mount Greylock Tower, which we're to help purchase. Blair, did you know about it? You're a board member, for God's sakes. Did you know about this?
Yes. Well, I wish you'd given us the blankets earlier. We might have been warmer in here.
It is. It's a beautiful fleece blanket. It's, 50 by 60 inches, and it has the silhouette of Mount Greylock on it. It is a gray fleece blanket. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. It has the WMC logo coming out of the sunshine, rising from the back of the mountain. And,
it's almost poetic.
It is, and it's beautiful. We have that. That logo is also on a pullover sweatshirt, which is deep gray and beautiful and just a very, very nice pullover sweatshirt. We also have our Mount Greylock socks. If you would like any one of those, $100. If you would like two, $200. If you'd like all three, $240.
Such a deal.
That's a deal. We need you. We want you. Look, we have $50,000 at risk here, and we need to make this money. It is a challenge. It is a challenge, and when you are challenged, you have to meet the challenge.
Joe, unlike anything we have ever seen before, we've never had a $50,000 challenge from one individual before, and only because she really does love this radio station, and we have great respect and love for her, but we don't want to let her down, and if each person just understands all the tchotchkes you can get, all the stuff that you can get, it pales in significance to keeping it all going. We got to keep it alive.
If you go to WAMC.org and you go to the pull-down menu, that's our tchotchke menu. And you can see all the stuff you can get. But at the end of the day, it's the money that comes in that's the important part that helps us get to this very, very important goal of $1.5 million before February 5th, 2018.
And by the way, we're completely transparent, and you can go and you can see the barber pole, which tells you exactly how much we have raised at any given moment, as this morning we were down to 438,912 to get to the $1.5 million that we need in order to go into the fund drive on February 5th. So I'm asking, if you haven't done it yet, could you do it? Could you say Alan sent me or Joe sent me? Whatever you can do, do it.
What was the total on your sheet there?
438,912.
No, but I mean, how much we were at? 1
million 61088.
So right now, if you check the thermometer, it's 1,062,144. So we are keeping track of the new of the new money coming in. So watch that raise and know that we need to get to 1.5 before the start of the drive on February 5th to get this $50,000.
Hey, Joe, all right. We could do it today.
We could do it today. Absolutely. We could do it today. Yeah, I mean, we have had $1 million fund drive in a day. We can make a $500,000 in half a day.
Well said.
All right. Let us.
Now we've got the math out of the way.
Right? That's right. Yeah, we've got the hard part out of the way. So let's just wrap up the thing of Prococo trial, and then we'll get into other. We'll get into the some federal business. But when we talk about this particular trial, Blair, 3 weeks, is that what we're thinking?
Well, I've heard as long as six. It could go as long as six. It's certainly not going to be super long, and it'll overlap with the next trial, as I mentioned, as they queue up on the aircraft carrier corruption.
And Preparara has been very clear that he did not mention Andrew Cuomo as being among
charged.
Those, that long list of people who are indicted. However, let me just say that I think that there's some real risk here to Cuomo because, after all, these were his closest friends, and he should have been keeping track as to what they were doing during this time. It's his administration. Hey, if something goes wrong here, I'm going to get held responsible, and I know it, and I think it's important that he be held responsible.
I was curious about the other trial. One of them is the Calieros trial, in that that was so intertwined with Cuomo and his, I'm not saying that the details of the trial itself, but he was so intertwined with Cuomo's upstate economic development initiative. So what does that mean for the upstate economic development? You know, do they continue to be intertwined, or what happens there?
Well, you're right. I mean, there's a second trial that's sort of connected to the one with Prococo. I mean, Todd Howe looms large in both cases. They're both about the state's economic development. The Prococo case focuses more on development in Syracuse and in the Mid-Hudson Valley, and the Calieros case focuses more on the Buffalo Billion. I mean, it appears that they're having problems with the sort of the Nano Center, which I guess has been running it. They've been running into financial problems, obviously having a cloud of corruption over the whole system doesn't help. The State University of New York also plays sort of a key role in the economic development strategies that Calieros put together. And the new chancellor there is a sort of a tech person. She comes from an engineering background.
She seems terrific.
And so it would seem like they're trying to fill some of the gaps from Calieros' absence, because he's sort of off the playing field now, to try to reinvigorate that strategy. But the whole idea was to use basically the I-90 corridor as a series of sort of high-tech industrial centers to re-stimulate the Utica, Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo economies. And who knows if it'll work? I mean, that's the big question. Does it work?
Yeah,
this doesn't help.
What I was curious about is how is that working now? Because he was so intertwined in what was going on in Albany. But the Utica Project, as you mentioned, the Syracuse, the Rochester Photonics, and then the Buffalo Billions. And I just, even almost separate from the trial, but as a result of it, you know, what's happening with all of those economic development
Teresa,
initiatives?
Well, Teresa, you know, you make a very good point here. Here's what. Look, Andrew Cuomo has New York City. He wins in New York City. He's got the Cuomo name. There are an awful lot of people who think well of him, even though there are an awful lot of people who are not happy about the way the subways have been working, which he sort of claimed credit for. But New York is his. His big problem is upstate New York. So he comes up with this plan that he's going to do economic development. People are going to compete for those economic development dollars. And now the ugly hand of corruption or potential corruption comes into the way that that money was being given out, of course. So as New York is apple pie, as the old saying goes. And that's what it is. I think that Andrew has to be worried that his very good signature program, which is to help upstate New York, is going south.
I get, you know, time will tell. And all
for the sake of all of the people that have invested a lot of time and interest, we've got to hope not. But that's, you know, how do you steady that ship given what's going on? Because a lot of people move to those places. They invested a lot of time and resources. So
and this goes
how do you
back.
Study
I mean,
that?
Kelly Arrows has been sort of the central character going back to Pataki. I mean, it's been a long time. The strategy's been playing out, and we'll see. I mean, they did replace. They have a different person running the economic development czar is a different person now. You have this change at SUNY. I mean, so my sense of it is, I don't think it's been explicitly described, but I think my sense of it is that's how they're trying to compensate for it, to give the impression and hopefully the reality that things continue to move forward in a positive way.
Yeah, we have to hope so.
We have a couple of letters. We'll get to those, and then we'll move on to other topics.
Okay. Mike says, I'm confused. Please help me. I'm confused. I understand the fight over DACA involved finding a way for DACA kids to remain in the U.S. So far, so good. Okay. Now I hear that Trump and the Republicans are seeking to include, quote, comprehensive immigration reform as part of the DACA agreement. That would include what Republicans call chain migration and replacing it with, quote, merit-based, the wall, an end to sanctuary cities. Doesn't this make getting a DACA agreement much more difficult? Ladies and gentlemen, did I say something wrong?
You asked the question, doesn't it make it more difficult?
Yes, it does.
No, you said exactly right, Alan.
If you guys followed what Mitch McConnell said on the floor the other day, it was quite clear what he was up to. He said, yes, I promised that we're going to open up the DACA discussion. We're going to have amendments, these very amendments that have been noted in this letter. So that's why, in my opinion, Chuck Schumer, this very morning, I said, I'm taking the wall off the table.
So that was our next topic. So let me just start that. We'll introduce it now. So Senate negotiators found themselves back at square one in immigration on Tuesday. The Senate Democratic leader withdrew the biggest gesture that he had made to strike a deal and offered to fully fund President Trump's proposed wall at the Mexican border. The wall is off the table, the leader, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, told reporters at the Capitol day after senators overcame an impasse to end a three-day government shutdown. Mr. Schumer's decision to renege, made on Sunday but revealed publicly on Tuesday, marked another turn in the fluid debate over how to shield from deportation hundreds of thousands of young immigrants brought to the country illegally as children. So back to the key wording here in this article, which is Senate negotiators found themselves back at square one. Are we really back to square one?
Well, if I could just finish that last thought of mine, which is that Schumer took it off the table, the wall off the table, so he would have something to negotiate with.
That's right.
I mean, he couldn't leave it there and say, I already promised you, so we'll start from somewhere else. He said, I'm taking this back, and then we'll see, you know, what comes up. We already know that he's willing to give in on the wall.
But that's one part of the parcel of what is being proposed as immigration reform, and that's the issue on the table. You know, DACA and the DREAM Act, which was proposed sort of under the Obama era, is something that the Trump administration, the current Republican Party, had looked to reform. They didn't like the stipulations there. The Republicans came up with their own sort of proposal with the Succeed Act, which is where I think this last letter, some of the language came from, like the idea of the merit-based system. It's essentially a 15-year pathway with various phases. There's a 5-year phase and then another 10-year phase to sort of prove your worthiness to be here. It separates families in some aspects, which is something that has been brought to the table too. But you know, the wall conversation and immigration reform is quite different than the wall conversation, which is you know, on one hand we have hundreds of thousands of people who are, you know, roughly my age, in their 20s and 30s, who are here in the U.S., probably have livelihoods, could be having their own children. So when we talk about families, it's not just, you know, we're going to bring in, you know, aunts and uncles from Mexico or wherever. They have, you know, other people. We've heard in some of the reports lately that it's people from Ireland. It's people from all over the world, really, who are affected by this. But then you have the issue of border security. And I don't think anyone is saying that we can't use, you know, better surveillance systems, you know, different methods of control, and that's sort of the controversy. But I think it's talked about in these particulates, and it's easy to nitpick and cherry pick what you're going to talk about and what you're going to stump about. And I think you really need to have a comprehensive conversation of what's the best long-term solution.
I mean, I have a feeling this is more about negotiating tactic than at the moment about substance.
Oh, absolutely.
So they got until February 5th. Every good negotiator waits to the last minute before they show their cards. They're pulling some cards back. They're going to battle it out and beat each other's brains in from now until around the 3rd of February, and then we might actually see the contours of a deal.
And then in all of this comes this sort of, Teresa, I'd love to hear what you think about this, because you've hung around the Senate long enough and worked there, this middle group of basically not conservative but middle-range Democrats and Republicans who say, we got to get through this kind of stuff.
The common sense coalition.
Yeah, and we're going to get a coalition, and we're going to come up with this. And that's how we got out of this last mess.
Right. And they have come together and they did what Donald Trump in that infamous, not the infamous, but the other White House meeting where he said, you bring me a deal, you get together, you bring me a deal, I'll sign it. And so they did what he asked. They came together, they put together a bipartisan deal, and they were ready to bring the deal. And then Stephen Miller in the White House and, by all accounts, General Kelly rejected the deal after Donald Trump said it was fine. So you have a problem that was created by Donald Trump for the DACA, these Dreamers. So he created this artificial March 5th deadline. The problem is that some of the young people are already being affected by this now. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the Democrats were saying this can't wait till March 5th. Some of them, their status has already expired. Their legal status has already expired. And so separately, you have a whole list of issues around immigration reform. Now, those separate issues, the Congress has been mulling over those and not been able to come to a resolution for 20 plus years. So the notion that they're going to thread that needle in the next 3 weeks is highly unlikely. Mm-hmm. And so they need to figure out some combination of things. And the sticking point, there's many, many sticking points, but a big sticking point is that how you count the DACA kids. So do you count them as part of the overall number of immigrants allowed in the country this year? Or do you keep the base immigrants and then add them to it? Because the conservatives want them counted into the overall number, which would then dramatically reduce the number of other people who can come in legally. But let's not forget the price tag here. Mm-hmm. Cato Institute, not a liberal organization at all. $60 billion to deport these young people and $200 billion plus in lost economic value. So not only is it the wrong thing to do just as we are as a country, but it's a price tag that they don't have a pay for. If you're going to have that kind of cost, what's your pay for? How are you going to pay for it? Now this conservative, this middle of the road group, come together trying to work out a problem, work out the problem, but you have the same situation you've had all along. You can get something through the Senate. It won't. You can't get it through the House because of the Freedom Caucus, unless Paul Ryan agrees that he'll build a coalition between moderate Republicans and Democrats.
And he needs the president to do that.
Well, you need Stephen Miller, apparently.
Right.
Apparently,
or whomever
apparently
speaks for the president.
Apparently, you need Stephen Miller and General Kelly.
We were talking yesterday, and I just, in a couple of minutes before we go to break here, we were talking yesterday about what all this means for Chuck Schumer. And as this latest announcement from him that it's off the table and through the negotiations, we have 17 days, as you mentioned, of all that has to be done, 16 days now. So how does he come out on this?
Well, he has to protect the 10 endangered senators,
right,
who are running in basically Trump states. So that's why he had to give in on this. He has to protect those people, because in the end, he's going to be known, as I said yesterday, for whether or not he got the Democrats into the majority,
that's right,
or whether he lost the majority. So that's why he did what he did. It's threading a needle, all right, but it's a tough one.
And it also sets it up so it's clearly on the Republicans this time to deliver. But they haven't. I mean, it was really, if you pair it all back, it was a failure of McConnell and Ryan. Their job as leaders is to deliver a coalition, whatever it is, either all their members or some combination, that moves the bill through. And behind all of this, the other thing besides immigration, that's the thing the Republicans want everybody to focus on, but there's the fundamental budget to run our government. Mm-hmm. You know, we're 4 months into this, the federal fiscal year, and there's no federal budget in place yet. On the Senate side, they've only held one budget hearing since July. It's ridiculous. And the other thing that the Republicans don't want to talk about is disaster aid. They have not figured out a way to fund disaster aid for
Absolutely.
California, Texas, whatever. They keep talking a good game on the opioid crisis, but they're not funding the opioid crisis. They did take care of the CHIP program, so that's off the table. But to have that work, you have to fund the neighborhood health centers. They haven't funded the neighborhood health centers yet. So there are a whole series of other issues that the Republicans don't want to talk about, because they want this all to be about the Democrats and immigration, but that they're all stacked up because they haven't figured out how to govern, because we have a president who can't lead. And now he's off to Davos.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll talk about as well. Let's go to a few more letters and then we'll go to a break.
Whatever you say, Joe.
Really?
Stephen says, I read in USA Today that the White House can now direct U.S. intelligence agencies to spend money and take covert action without approval of congressional oversight committees under a provision slipped into the bill that ended the government shutdown, leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee say. Panel opinion?
Yikes.
I think that they resolved the FISA issue there. Is that what they're talking about? I don't know. I'd have to look
that
one up.
I just read the thing. And Joe's instructions, I just read the letter.
No,
it's all my fault.
The FISA issue is being looked into to see if there is any abuses of power under the Obama administration. There's not a lot.
Memo.
Yeah.
And Mike, they read it in the USA Today, so it's got to be true.
And it can't be that long. Mike says, I am confused.
All right.
Okay. Please help me. I am confused. I understand the fight over DACA involved finding a way.
Did we read that one?
I'm so sorry.
Right.
I don't know how that happened.
It's less confusing now.
Mike, I'm confused too, Mike, as are all the...
Yeah, I'm very confused. Lars says, Mount Greylock and Harry Potter. Hello, all. According to the authority on the Wizarding World, J.K. Rowling claims that North American School of Witches and Wizards is located on Mount Greylock.
Correct.
But unfortunately is invisible to the Muggle eye.
So noted.
Well, there is magic here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Blair. Okay.
Anne says, good morning.
Good morning,
Anne.
We blame the Trump administration for distractions and rightly so, but how long will we continue to push gun control under the rug? It's as if we are not recognizing the first fatal school shooting of the year, and there seems to be less and less news
coming. It's not the first.
It's the 11th
and the 50th of the academic year.
And there seems to be less and less news coverage of these tragedies. Kudos to the media project. You know, I was thinking about something there. As this news of yesterday's shooting by, a fifth grader?
15-year-old.
High school.
Fifth grade, yeah. Certainly 15.
No, 15.
Comes over. I was so struck by the fact that one of the mothers who was in such terror that this could have been her kid had her arm around the mother of the shooter. In other words, comforting her, that it was so poignant. I thought it was an incredible.
Well, and it's a small town. There's we actually have this story on our docket today of talking about just how we're numb to this and the fact that this is not the first school shooting of the year, and that we and how we report these. Obviously, in this case, there were two fatalities. There are five people who are in critical condition, five children who are in critical condition. So we'll talk more about it in a little bit. But it is numbing and really hard to
horrific.
To get your brain around.
And we cannot normalize.
No, you can't. Absolutely.
And so Doreen writes, I would like to know what Alan thinks is going on with Dershowitz and his defense of Trump. What the heck happened to Dershowitz? And that's from Doreen, you know, in Potown and Poughkeepsie. And my answer is, I don't speak for him, although we got a letter the other day saying you have Alan Dershowitz on your panel every single day. And I'm getting sick of it. No, you don't have Alan Dershowitz on the panel. And there's a long distance between Alan Chartok and Alan Dershowitz. Let me just say, I can't speak for Dershowitz, and I don't want to, and I don't understand him either. Okay.
All right. Ray is pointing to his watch, which I think indicates it's time to go over to the news. We'll hold the next letter, and we'll come back. We'll return, and we have many other items to discuss. We will do that with our panel, Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Blair Horner, Teresa Bourgeois. I'm Joe Donahue. We'll be back after this.
And not Alan Dershowitz.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Because he is the most powerful man in Albany, Blair Horner had to leave.
Yeah, he had to probably had to talk to the New York Times again.
He had to go. So we thank Blair for being with us this morning. Glad we got to talk about the trial and other things. So thanks to Blair, but we'll have him back soon. We have a great panel here. Alan Chartok is here, Jen Smith, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. This from the Washington Post. Shortly after President Trump fired his FBI director in May, he summoned to the Oval Office the Bureau's acting director for a get-to-know-you meeting. The two men exchanged pleasantries, but before long, Trump, according to several current and former U.S. officials, asked Andrew McCabe a pointed question. Whom did he vote for in the 2016 election? McCabe says he didn't vote, according to officials who, like other interviewed for the article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to talk candidly about a sensitive matter. Trump, the official said, also vented his anger at McCabe over the several $100,000 in donations that his wife, a Democrat, received for her failed 2015 Virginia State Senate bid from a political action committee controlled by a close friend of Hillary Clinton. McCabe is 49 years old. He has been the FBI deputy director for a little more than a year when James Comey was fired, and now is at the center of much of the political jockeying surrounding the investigation into a potential coordination between Trump associates and the Kremlin. So
it would appear that the Republican onslaught, they see the train coming down the track. So now the name of the game is to go after the FBI, to go after the people who could embarrass them. And it's once again propaganda 101. You keep saying it over and over again. There is this phony Maloney memo that they say that they have, but that they can't release, that is very disturbing. The Democrats say it's all a bunch of nonsense. We know where this is going. But what I'm fascinated with here is that Trump and that the special prosecutor in his relationship with Trump seems to be suggesting that where they're going, and at least this is what the tea leaves are showing, is obstruction of justice. And so that is fascinating to me that, you know, as they ask people, you know, what were you doing? What was this all about? You know, why did you fire Comey? He talked to the Russians. You guys will remember that right afterwards. He said, don't worry about that anymore. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about that anymore. I fired Comey. Come on.
So, Teresa, what do you think of this?
It's shocking, but not surprising.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I keep thinking about how outraged the Republicans were when Bill Clinton spoke with the Attorney General Loretta Lynch on the tarmac for 20 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. She had been his appointee. You know, his version, they talked about the grandkids. The Republicans went nuts forever. Yet you have the President of the United States having McCabe in the White House, asking him who he voted for and talking about his wife, when in fact McCabe meticulously handled his wife's running for office, by all accounts. And in fact, the paperwork on that has been now made public. All the meticulous steps he took to make sure that there were no conflicts of interest around the fact that his wife was running for public office in Virginia. Yet his reputation continues to be sullied inappropriately by the President of the United States around this issue and all the people around him. I mean, this is just not how democracy is supposed to work. I understand in the Trump world it is. But this denigration of the FBI is inappropriate and dangerous. Mm-hmm. The denigration of our, you know, the CIA and the others, and this Nunes memo is just...
Nunes, you'll remember, they found hiding in the woods there, hiding in the weeds at the White House that
and
time.
If you watch Fox News, you would have a whole different view of this. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem we have in this country right now. You wonder why people think the way they do. Well, if all you did was watch Fox News, I've been watching Fox around this. This is what they're talking about.
The president is going to Davos.
And so before he went, he's leaving tonight. And before he went, what did he do? He slapped some tariffs
on solar
panels and a few other
washing machines.
And before he got there, though, Modi, the head of India, he gave a keynote address, and he talked about climate change and the environment and the leadership role they're going to take. And he talked about globalization and the fact that we're all in this together, and directly and indirectly took a shot at Trump.
Of course, India has, to be fair, India has a long way to go.
They do, but at least they're at the table and active. Mm-hmm. But Trudeau spoke yesterday and announced that he's put together a coalition to go ahead with the TPP and trade agreements without Trump and without the U.S. Mm-hmm. And he hopes he'll come to the table on NAFTA, but if he doesn't, they're prepared to go ahead. And so all of these folks are giving the, you know, we're all in this together
message.
Well,
they're all trying to, I think, get out their points of view. And I think what will happen with the current media attention, I don't think the U.S. media has paid this much attention to this summit in, you know, even when Clinton was office, who was the last president to go. And so, you know, my concern is that, you know, whatever Trump says will upstage whatever really thoughtful things that have been said by Modi or Merkel or Trudeau or, you know, even, you know, many of the other participants, and even, you know, our own representative who is there now is trying to play down the rhetoric that's expected, which is this America first attitude, which has nothing to do with, you know, the crux of the summit. So I think it will be interesting to see how what Trump says at the end of the week will be weighted with what's been said, you know, each day this week so far at the summit, which has to do with, you know, the preservation and protection and building of connections and collaborations of world economic transactions.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, he's going to meet with Theresa May because, of course, he can't go to London, right? So the president of the United States, because of all the protests, they can't figure out a time for him to go to London. So he's going to meet with her there. And then he's going to meet with Netanyahu, of course. But he's also going to meet with the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, who's the head of the Coalition of African Countries, trying to do some damage control because of what he said about African countries. But last year at this, Xi Jinping gave a speech which many thought was signaling his rise. And I think as Trump becomes more and more isolated and isolates us, then China is getting much stronger. One had hoped that Merkel would step into that, but she's having some political troubles of her own.
I'll be curious if the Paris Accord comes up again at this summit, or you know, we haven't heard about that being talked about in months.
But Modi essentially talked. He essentially said the climate is something we all need to work on together. You know, you can't be on the sidelines on the climate issue. Basically calling Trump to task on that. So we'll see what happens, and we'll see if he's going to give, as David Gergen from Harvard, who's served several presidents, he said the interesting thing to watch is in his speeches, Trump typically talks to a single audience, which is his base. And so is his speech going to be to his base, or is it going to be to the world? And that will be the signal.
His speech will be to the base.
That's what I think, too. And that will be wrong.
Well, it's where he thinks he got, how he got where he is right now. And he's not about to change that in order to become a statesman, in my mind.
But, Alan, you know, less than a week from now, he's got to give a State of the Union next Tuesday. So what's that going to be? He doesn't have a budget. He couldn't govern enough to put a budget in place. He created this problem with immigration that he can't solve. He, you know, the whole litany of things. So what's he going to do? He's going to talk about the taxes.
Theresa,
he's
going to talk
about the
really
taxes.
Do you really think he's going to get up there and say what you just said?
No, he's not.
He's going to say
taxes.
Taxes and the economy is going strong, and I got a Supreme Court justice appointed.
And in case you didn't know, I won the election.
And I have a new person running our, you know, economic action. So I think Janet Yellen is out, the new guy's in. Those are the things he's going to talk about.
And yeah. He's not going to talk about how all of these gerrymandering state after state after state now.
Certainly
the courts
not.
Have cut down on their gerrymandering and look around and say, okay, this is the last time I'll be talking to a Republican-controlled House and Senate. I have a Republican-controlled House and Senate, and I can't even get a budget through.
Yeah.
He won't be saying that.
I hate to change the subject, Joe, but I have to say that we just heard word from the front office that the phones are ringing off the hook right now in terms of some of the stash that we're giving out.
So the thing that seems to be moving the needle, and we're very happy about this, is that, you know, people like things individually, but people also like a full set. And if you want the beautiful fleece blanket, the beautiful pullover gray lock sweatshirt, and the gray lock socks, which we have a picture of, but we don't have yet. Although we have a tracking number, so they'll apparently be here very soon. You can have all three of those for $240. If you want any one of them, it's $100. If you want two, it's $200. If you want all three, it's $240. And so if you are a collector of WAMC stuff, if you just want to support WAMC and support the Tower Fund and show it off to your friends and family, then that's a great way to go. The blanket is beautiful. It's very soft. It's very nice. Very, very cool. You know, I was thinking I had my...
Fleece, right?
Yeah. My father-in-law, it was turned out not to be as serious as we had originally thought. alive, thank God, but he was in the hospital over the weekend, and they gave him a little blanket, and it was about the size of a dishcloth, but it was a little blanket, and I said, oh, that's very nice, and she said, oh, you get to take that home with you, and we said, oh, great, and I said, well, how much will that be on the bill, and she said, oh, probably $87,
oh, goodness.
And I thought to myself, well, then what a bargain this is, then.
But the only real reason is because of your love and affection for WAMC. And, you know, the swag is great, but in the end, it's deadly serious.
I just think about you. You've mentioned the number of people who listen and don't.
500,000 a month.
And who don't give. So
that's
maybe
a lot of people.
10 of them right now, if you're listening, right?
Well, let me say this. I do know that most people are good.
Inside,
most people are good. They are. They know what's right. Their parents taught them what was right. They know what's right. Their children are encouraging them. They'll do what they have to do to keep WAMC whole. Somebody wrote in just now and said, you're being disingenuous. You don't really care. Oh, boy, do I care. Do I care that we keep this going?
Oh, of course you care. You started it from a tiny station in the basement of the Albany Med, right?
And somebody wrote in and said, you know, what are you doing? We all get it. We all get it. Hey, the day we all get it is the day that the fund drive is over right now. Is that simple?
1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. We also, 1-800-323-9262. You can also go online and do it, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We have all the stuff here, by the way, on the console, and if you want to see it, there are pictures on the website, but you can also go to WAMC.org, watch the web stream, and see it's what's in the middle of the table, just so you know.
I don't know why I just thought about the panda cam.
Don't start with a panda cam again. All right, let's do.
Can we talk about Kentucky?
Yes, I do want to talk about
this
Kentucky.
This is an issue near and dear to my heart as someone who has worked in schools, as someone who has been to Connecticut to cover Sandy Hook. I grew up in the Columbine era, in the Virginia Tech era. And I think this is a nation that's sick and tired of thoughts and prayers. I think this is a nation that deserves legislative action on gun control, on oversight, on talking about regulations, and also talking to students and families and looking at their policies, you know, what's happening with in schools, just to report protections. And, you know, if you see a sign that something's going to happen, how do you report it?
We gave these numbers a moment ago. I want to add a couple, but just make sure that they actually connect with people. So on Tuesday, it was, yes, this high school in Benton, Kentucky. On Monday, a school cafeteria outside of Dallas and a charter school parking lot in New Orleans. Before that, a school bus in Iowa and a college campus in Southern California, a high school then in Seattle. The gunfire is ringing out in our schools. There have been, as of, again, here are the numbers. It was at least 11 shootings on school property recorded since January 1st. Roughly the 50th of the academic year. Researchers and gun control advocates say that since 2013, they have logged school shootings at a rate of one a week.
Boy.
Mm-hmm. One a week.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And the gun industry has made an extra $20 billion in the past 2 years, according to association statistics. That is terrifying to me.
And one of our writers wrote that this is becoming the new normal. And as a result of that, people are not paying attention to these horrendous things that are happening and say, oh, just another one. That's when we really lose.
This idea of we call because, and I heard this a couple of times yesterday, and I shuddered because that, well, there were only, and I heard this on the media, where there's only two fatalities.
Only two.
That is a lot, you know, and we use the word massacre in Virginia Tech and Columbine, but two people dying and five in critical condition and 15 others injured, that's a massacre too.
Yeah, and think if it was your kid.
Right.
I mean, it's that simple.
And everyone in that school is a victim. Mm-hmm. They will never forget that for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they say, well, only five were injured or only what, but everyone there was injured.
Ask anyone who lives in Great Barrington, for example, and what happened at Simon's Rock. Yeah. Every time we just reported on an anniversary, and every time we do, we hear victims who are still traumatized, and we try to be careful about our reporting. And it's a reminder of how much this affects people. One of my friends is an elementary administrator out in Las Vegas. You can't look at these things. It goes beyond just school violence, too. Yes, we saw a spike in bump stock legislation, but if someone's out to shoot someone, they're still going to do it. And I think there needs to be just more coverage on what are the issues in terms of legislation. You know, if you look at, we need more statistics out there about who, you know, how accessible weapons are in our communities and our country.
The weapons and the guns are certainly a part of it, absolutely, and an important part of it. Also, though, we have to work on our mental health system that allows the mind of a 15-year-old to want to do this in the first place. Mm-hmm. They're victims, too. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, they are.
Right.
Something that has gone horribly, horribly wrong with that individual that thinks that this is the way of solving whatever problem they have going on in their head. Mm-hmm. And that mental health has to be taken care of.
And the thing that boggles my mind the
most
are
children.
Is that there's research now, because we have so much data from all these shooting incidents and violent incidents, that we can start to analyze, you know, what's actually effective. You know, since these, certain weapons bans have been in place, you know, have incidence rates changed and things like that? There needs to be more done.
We're out of time, but I want to thank everybody for being with us. We'll be back tomorrow. We welcome your calls to help us with the lockbox, 1-800-323-9262.
We need help.
Huge challenge on the table, 1-800-323-9262.